Guy and I have been constantly asked about what to do in the face of abrupt climate change and near-term human extinction, and we've been asked how to respond to a culture gone mad. Today we are joined by two extraordinary women, Amma and Boo. Both have made choices that many are too fearful to ever consider, and both have the foresight early in their lives to live rather than make a living. They have been living on the fringe of the dominant culture for decades and have a wealth of knowledge most of us will never approach. We are honored to have their wisdom on Nature Bats Laugh. This is a show where our guests have done what most of us only contemplate. Welcome to the show, Amma and Boo.
Hi, Mike. Thank you. Hi, Mike, and hi, everybody out there.
Thanks for joining us. Can you start with a couple of words about yourselves? I know, Boo, you have a little bit written up here where you can tell us about yourself. Maybe you can start us off.
Well,
You don't need to read it. You know yourself.
I gave it to you to read, Guy.
I was raised in Arizona and by fairly lenient parents, so I got to love and like being with Mother Nature very early on. I did not do well in academia and other such things, and I always kind of fled to the desert. When I was 19 in 1969, I was given a chance to go to Alaska and work in Denali Park, which I did do. And after that, I refused to return to, I was raised in Tucson, to Tucson where the options I'd been presented with were not doable. I stayed in Alaska for almost 30 years, built a homestead, learned much about myself and Mother Nature. And after 30 years of that, I came through the New Mexico and camped, enjoyed the people I met camping. I enjoyed the wilderness there, even though it was not Alaska. It's an awesome wilderness. And I've remained for the last 16 years working on a small community. There's, I don't know, maybe 10 of us, wonderful people. And we've kind of figured out a way to live together, to honor the land, honor one another, be free, be cooperative, and be free. And now I'm here.
Excellent. So you're here. So obviously you're still capable of making some mistakes. Amma, why don't you hit us with a little bit of your story?
Well, I don't know. Mike sent me an email saying, start by telling us who you are. And I went, what? I don't know how to answer that question. He said, okay, I'll ask you questions and lead you into it.
Okay, so here we go. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, in the beginning, because I go to Amma's place every morning to check my email and usually in the evening to check my email, so she's my internet connection. And I sit on her porch, and we usually have a conversation about something going on, and sometimes it's lighthearted and sometimes it's serious. And we talk a great deal about why we are doing what we're doing and living the way we're living. And we were both teachers, and my last year of teaching, I talked to my students a great deal about debt and avoiding the debt culture and becoming a wage slave. So, Amma, why don't you start with your story about how you came to live in a bus and buying the bus?
How I bought the bus. Okay. This has to do with debt, but making a good bargain wasn't really the main reason that I've never been in debt. But I'll tell you the story of the bus. I was in Missouri on the land, and we bought a piece of land, and the old farmhouse didn't have enough room for all of us. So I decided to buy a school bus. So I saved up $1,000, and I went to look at school buses, found a used bus lot, which is remarkably like a used car lot. And when I found a bus that pleased me,
I got my $1,000 in cash and I stuck it in my inner jacket pocket. And I went to see the used bus salesman, who was remarkably like a used car salesman. And I told him I liked that particular bus. He wanted $1,500 for it. And I said, but I only have $1,000. And I pulled my money out of my pocket and kind of waved it in front of his nose and stuck it back in. I only have $1,000 and I never borrow money. So he told me what a fine bus it was, and I agreed with him all the way. Yeah. He says, it's easily worth $1,700. I says, maybe, but all I have is $1,000 and I never borrow money. He says, I sold one just like it for $1,750 the other day. I said, you must have been very pleased. Congratulations. But I don't have $1,750. I only have $1,000 and I never borrow money. So we went through a couple more rounds of this kind of thing. And finally, he went down to $1,250 and I gave him the same line. And he looked a little desperate and he said, Madam, I personally will loan you the extra $250. And I said, oh, thank you. That's very kind of you, but I never borrow money. And in desperation.
Not even from a used car salesman?
Nope. In desperation, he sold it to me for $1,000. I lived in that bus for 30 years after I outfitted. And got rid of it about 15 years ago when I was able to build myself a little house. But I do want to say that making good deals is not the reason I never borrow money. The reason is because if I borrowed money, I would make myself enslaved and impoverished. You borrow money, you always lose, mm-hmm. and you always enslave yourself. Mm-hmm. And I won't do it, and I've never borrowed money in my life.
And by the way, you lived in that bus for $33 a year. Which comes out to just over a buck a day. That's not bad.
Not bad at all. And I never paid rent.
Not a
anywhere.
Buck a day. Less than that. Way less than that. Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that a real key to this conversation today is what I've learned specifically from our two guests over the years that I've known them, and they've never bought into what everyone else that I know in my life is bought into, and that is being a wage slave. And they've avoided it. And you've mentioned, you know, going back to the land as an alternative to going to work. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. What exactly, you know, because that's a term that many people don't use all that much anymore. What does that term mean to both of you, going back to the land?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, stop it. No, you go first. No, you go first. Will, you go first.
You know, I don't feel like I returned to the land as much as Alma was more thoughtful of that. I always made choices in my life because I'm, I guess, a very selfish person, but that didn't sound like fun. Going to Rome on the desert sounded like fun. I went to do it. So, and it wasn't until I was 50 that I really was cognizant of what wage slavery really meant. I just know I dodged it my whole life. So there's been nothing planned about my escape. I just kind of escaped because it was more fun.
So you never got into the prison to begin with?
Not really. You know, when I was 16, I had a job because I was 16, and I went every day. And then, but when I decided to leave, I just left.
Have you told them yet? Because they might be missing you.
That is kind of a problem. When you just, this doesn't work, I'm out of here.
Uh-huh. And Ami, you specifically use the term back to the land.
Well, I did do the wage slave thing for 11 years. I taught elementary school. I got myself a master's degree. I did everything I was supposed to do, and it was miserable. And I did not like wage slavery. So I wound up dropping out. I was involved with a small group who were trying to fix our psychological problems. We called it working on our heads. Mm-hmm. And I talked most of the group into going back to the land with me, by which I meant buy a piece of land, live in the country, be as self-sufficient as you possibly can. But this was something that I always wanted to do. All my life I wanted to live in the country and be self-sufficient as you can. So it wasn't anything new when I did it.
Well, that brings up a good point. You put in a qualifier there at the end, self-sufficient. as you can. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the as you can part. I mean, at some level, we're all born into captivity. We're all part of the system. We can't fully escape, try as we might. Can each of you talk about that a little bit?
I think that there's very strong programming I found in the bush. I just kind of went out there. It was March, and there was this piece of land that I could have if I could find it.
And this is in Alaska, right?
This was in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I was actually, by the fact that I survived the even first day, I was self-sufficient. It grew from there. I mean, I learned there was berries, there was this, there was that. I do garden. Self-sufficiency is in the moment. Are you happy right now? Are you scurrying because you have to have something else so you're more self-sufficient? And when I left Alaska and then I'm here in the Southwest, I go, well, there's foods here too. And I go, oh, those aren't. And when I looked at it, the foods in Alaska available were much more prolific. However, you can be self-sufficient here. There's a fellow who lives across the river from me who's basically self-sufficient. You're only self-sufficient if you're not wanting something else.
Well, I'm looking at it like I have a garden and chickens, and people say, oh, that's marvelous how self-sufficient you are. I buy my chicken food in town. I don't raise my chicken food. That's not what I call self-sufficient because I need town.
Mm-hmm. Right, so there are shades of gray here, right, from one of our neighbors who actually is virtually capable of supporting everything he needs, but he still uses money because he needs beer. I mean, he wants beer.
How much do you have to give up of yourself to get that money?
Well, right. No, that's an excellent
point. There it is. If it's nothing. I mean, if I can go make a few bucks by helping my neighbor carry her chicken food over, then, okay, then I got those few bucks to play with. However, why am I not okay without doing that? I am not okay not helping. That is the self-sufficiency.
Yeah, so it seems to me most people can't even grasp that concept. You know, we throw around the word sustainability a lot and being sustainable. And then people come often to visit Guy, and then they come to the yurt, and they come to potluck at the community. And it seems that, and I went through this myself, that people are somewhat afraid of what the learning curve may be to doing what it is both of you have done for decades. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I know it's learn on the fly, but were there failures? Were there things and moments of clarity in your life where you thought, okay, if I can just pull this off, something good may come of it? Maybe talk about, you know, kind of the learning curve throughout your life.
So far.
Well, you just jump in and start doing it. There's no use hoping to be trained beforehand.
Right.
You start doing it and make whatever mistakes you make and fix it up from those mistakes and keep on going. That's all I know.
But sometimes the mistakes are lethal.
Well, I'm still here, so they haven't been lethal to me.
Sometimes non-mistakes are lethal.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, from what I can tell, you know, and I, over the years of talking to you both, there's very little fear. And I'm wondering if that's always been the case, because most people are very afraid to do anything different, let alone live a lifestyle that both of you have chosen to live, throughout the decades. Was that always the case, or you're fearless?
I think for myself, I had the...
Well, that's your problem, you think, for yourself. You should probably knock that off. Sorry.
Leaping in when you've done it. I know I was amazed, you know, after surviving my first winter in Alaska. I was amazed when I was a little kid and I survived running my bicycle off this little wooden thing. Survival is kind of amazing if you're, you know, it's, excuse me for quoting Nike, it's really just do it. That's really all you have to do. You may survive, you may not survive. That happens to be life. Is what you're doing valuable? Does it lead to inner contentment? Are you amused? Are you entertained? Are you having a great time? Are you glad you woke up this morning, even if you forgot to cut a tree so you don't have the firewood, it's going to be 50 below? Okay, that could be fun too. It really can. Do we dread life? Do we dread misfortune? Do we dread unhappiness? You're going to dread it, everything. So just do it.
What about you, Emma? Fear, did fear ever play a significant role? I mean, the culture that we are all part of does not provide much reward for taking risks, for doing things outside the system, for even thinking about living different life. You get disparagement.
That's true, but remember at the time that I dropped out was in the early 70s, and lots of people were dropping out in the 60s and 70s, which made it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was one of the scarier things I've ever done. Before I announced that I was going to quit my job, I had a week of horrible anxiety attacks, and I couldn't sleep, and I could hardly eat. But the minute I announced it, it was okay. Mm-hmm. Usually it's the anticipation that's scary.
Yeah, I agree.
Once you get started doing something, you're just doing it. It's not so scary anymore. It's thinking about, oh my God, what would happen if I, you know, that's what's scary.
Right. And I think hope is the other side of that fear coin, right? The two four-letter words that we project into the future. We hope something is going to turn out, or we fear the way that something is going to turn out. But if we just throw ourselves into it, it seems like those feelings, those emotions just diminish. Mm-hmm. They go away.
Well, I'll tell you, if you go back to the land, I went back to the land in Missouri and tried to turn a little bitty old farm into something productive. You are not going to have time for fear and hope. You're going to be so bloody busy every day and so tired at night that that's it.
I've been experiencing that difficulty myself the last week or so.
Yeah, it comes up. I think for myself, what I feared most is having to pursue the sort of life. This way, I was born in 1950, so the life I was presented that I could do was so unacceptable.
That, so confining.
So confining. I could get married. I could help somebody else. I could have kids. Okay, those are all great. A career, I could do what? I'm not good at. My fear of falling into that rut made anything else much more acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So I took chances. I took risks. I mean, anything but that.
That really leads me into my next. I mean, obviously, traditional gender roles, and you are very two strongly independent women, there have to have been challenges along the way inside the system and outside the system. For being women and doing what you're doing, and doing it for so long, obviously you followed very little of the traditional roles and the traditional route you were supposed to take. I was wondering if you could talk, who touched upon that just a little bit, so.
Was the question, Mike?
What are the challenges of being women and doing what you're doing? I mean, you came from an era where, highly independent, strong women was not something that was necessarily looked upon with valor. So what were some of those challenges being women coming in, you know, and doing what you're doing at such a young age?
Well, I think probably just by my style of just doing it. After the fact, people were saying, a woman alone in the bush in Alaska from Arizona, please. But I've been there. I had a cabin, okay? I had to keep working on this cabin to have a cabin, but I'd already done it. Point was already done. It's like, why argue with somebody who thinks you can't do something you're already doing?
Right.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners, because we had something of a messy start there, Mike and I are visiting today with Amma and Boo, two neighbors of ours who have been living quite differently for the last several decades. They went back to the land, they escaped contemporary culture from early ages, and have been living in a land trust not far from me. for the last decade or so. Can you talk about the land trust and that experience? And was that the first time the two of you met? Was on that land?
No, we met before then.
I had met before. I came into this area and people said, you need to meet Alma. I came in on a camping trip, which actually, when I ended up in the bush in Alaska, it was also a camping trip. Both times I refused to leave. And I am of the sort that if some place feels home, I don't care where it is, I'm there, and I stay there for as long as that was. This area felt like home when I came here. I was leaving Alaska, not for good, just I was just not there right then. And the people that I met, Alma, and many other people in this area were a lot like the Alaskan people I was used to. So I felt right at home.
Well, I don't know that I had any external discouragements as a woman, but the way I was raised made it a little more difficult. I can remember when I was a kid, my mother saying, you know, some little electrical thing went wrong, and she'd say, I don't know how to fix that. I don't understand those things. Men understand these things. I don't understand them. So, of course, you know what slant I grew up with.
Right.
And it was kind of hard to get over it.
Sure. Well, I mean, it was not long after World War II. It was pretty much peak patriarchy.
Yeah, I was born in 1939.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'm not at all surprised that 50s and 60s mentality was all about separation of work projects, of domestic life from professional life.
But I had a real epiphany experience when I was on the land. I was still very afraid to try anything new because I was afraid I would make a mistake. And I was building a desk for myself, kind of under the tutelage of my fellow homesteader, John, who was a self-taught carpenter.
And I should point out, by the way, that Alma is an excellent carpenter in her own right, regardless of what she's about to say. Go ahead.
Well, this was just when I was beginning. So I made a mistake, and I screwed the desk up. And I ran into John in the house. John, I screwed it up. I really screwed it up. So he says, well, let's have a look. And he comes out and looks at it with me. He says, well, I don't see what the problem is. Just take it apart and replace this piece, longer ones, and you're fine. And he turned around and walked into the house. And I stood there as if struck by lightning because I suddenly realized it's okay to make a mistake. You can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped being afraid of mistakes, and that was probably the biggest forward step.
That's excellent. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know if that has to do with being a woman or not. But...
Well, it does. It certainly has to do with non-traditional gender roles because I think most of us are inculcated into this society of fear, and one of the dominant fears of that is that of making a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We all know people who are afraid to pour lemonade into somebody's glass because they're afraid it might slop over.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like such a tiny thing, but that's where this culture goes, ultimately, is to this fearful mentality. Talk, if you will, about moments of clarity. Times when you just had, Alma, you just mentioned one. It was like a lightning strike, right? You had this moment of clarity. Surely there must have been others along the way.
Well, I had one good one from my experiences in the bush. At camp for the first year, I was trying to figure out how to build a log cabin. And at one point, there was a bear that came down the trail because I'd put my camp right on a trail. And it was a bear trail, and bugged me while I was making my coffee. I had an excellent dog that chased the bear out. I went back to making my coffee around the campfire, and then pretty soon my dog exploded and chased the bear. Four times through that, I dumped my coffee pot. I turned around and charged the bear, and it was just, I didn't even think about it. It was just like, damn. Well, it worked. You know, my wolf dog could chase it off for a minute. I chased it off for good. Another time later on, I worked the Alyeska pipeline, which is an absurd place for a woman to begin with. This is 1975. And the Alyeska contractor came through, and I'd had a legitimate request to be moved off the team of guys I was working with because they were out of control. And he kind of put it on the back burner, and I saw him, and it was the same way of going after the bear. Alyeska Bechtel contractor ran from me and left me in the woods, took the crew with them. They all left and sent a bus back later that night to get me. However, this was my epiphany, is that, you know, take it head on and deal with it.
Yeah, and I think for me, that's what most people, it's the fear we talked about earlier. They don't necessarily take on that fear. They push it away and they avoid it. And it seems to me that many of the people that live at the land trust, minus me, have just kind of reacted instead of overthinking things and, you know, going through with the possibilities of what could happen and this and that and just, you know, hand-wringing over it. And people that, what I've learned in a short period of time since I've lived there is people literally, like you said, they just do it and the consequences are the consequences and then you deal with them. That's frightening for people. It was frightening for me. And I think what I've learned is that, like Amma mentioned, it's okay to screw up. And we're going to screw up a lot. Switching gears here a little, people ask me all the time, usually every month or so, what my daily life is like. And I know your daily lives are different because you're different people and you react to the world differently. I was wondering, Amma, if you could take us through kind of what a typical day might look for you in the spring on your property.
Well, I get up very early because I like getting up very early. And I have about half an hour of meditation and half an hour of yoga. And when it gets light, I go out and do the chores, which is mostly chicken chores at this point. You have to let them out, feed them, water them, and have breakfast. And then I water my garden. And here in the desert southwest, one waters every day. So that always happens. And then I usually have some kind of project going. Well, I need to paint my porch deck next. This is nothing exciting or new. It's just the things that need to be done. And I don't know what to tell you. My days vary a whole lot, and I like that. I don't like being doing the same thing every day.
How about you, Boo?
Well, my main project for this community has been to design a community area because this is important to me. So I'm very much involved with the different community members or their friends who maybe wander through my life. I get up early in the morning. Right now I'm doing a campfire, and I make my coffee. I smoke a cigarette with it. Whoever, Amma often will come through and tell me with the weather report she's heard, or John Pope will come by for a, oops, I shouldn't be giving names here. Sorry, Pope.
Let's say it six or eight more times.
You know, as long as you're going to give his last name, I've got to say that John's grandfather was from this area, and he was a well-known citizen who had a dual career. He was a judge and a bootlegger.
There we go.
I'm pretty much, when I do my own garden, I do my own thing. That is one thing about this community is we're self-sufficient. If you want a building, you figure out a building. If you want a camp, you can do that. If you want a garden, you do your garden. And then we participate in keeping the community going and whole. As I said, I've been focusing on a community center, so we have a good place to get together, or where guy comes over hungry every Sunday night, there's a place for him to put his cake down and a bowl.
I'm hungry other days, too. I just don't show up at your place.
So, next question, Mike.
Your daily lives, at least the technology in your daily life as far as, being online and things like that and being on the telephone is pretty limited. And I know both of you don't have, you're not exactly big fans of technology. So I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about either resisting that, because obviously it's such a factor in all our lives today, and what role technology plays in your daily life, if any.
Very little. If we're talking the internet and electronics and everything, I know lots of people who say, that they get on it and the time just flies and all of a sudden a couple of hours have gone. Never works that way for me. I get bored very quickly. I get restless in 15 minutes. I say, let's get up and go do something real. So I'm not on the internet very much.
But you have internet.
I do
and,
have internet.
And you access it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you have telephone and sort of the mm-hmm. what many would consider the modern conveniences. Although I suspect most people in this culture don't consider it a modern convenience unless you have Google Glasses on or something ridiculous like that. But I think you're more averse to being online than even Alma is.
Well, I really tried. Again, I just did it. I think for myself, from the time I was 19 on, I've lived off-road, off-grid. So a lot of the things that have happened in America, I just haven't interfaced with. I did get my very first telephone 3 years ago, and I enjoy having it. But that's because I'm doing more of this community effort right now. So adverse, I don't know if it's adverse. I just have never needed those things.
Mm-hmm. But we're Facebook friends, right?
We're not friends, Guy. We're not friends.
Who came on Facebook? When was that? About 2-3 months ago? You had a borrowed device and you friended me on, and me and like three other people on Facebook.
I made a mighty effort.
And then you got on Facebook 10 minutes later, well, never to be seen again.
I just never got back on. I mean,
so you're still there. People are waiting for your next post.
Could be, and I'm really sorry about all that, folks.
I have a friend request that is still pending.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, both of you obviously over the years have gravitated towards community. Alma, you've been involved in community, it seems, ever since you left to go back to the land, as you put it. And Boo, you lived pretty independent on your own for a long time. Obviously, you talked to me about your camp in Alaska and you had people passing through, but talk about community, the importance of it, and why near the Gila?
While you think about that, let me give the standard announcement. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bass Last on PRN. Mike and I are conversing with Alma and Boo, two of our friends and neighbors who went back to the land, or maybe never left the land, decades ago, and are pursuing lives most of us could not even imagine. So Mike just asked a great question. Alma, why don't you hit us with it?
Well, let's see. When I wanted to go back to the land, it was perfectly obvious to me that I could not do this by myself. There were just too many things to do and too much to learn. So I wanted to take a group with me. So I had this group I was already involved with, so I just kept talking community and back to the land to them, and finally, 8 people agreed to go, and 3 finally did. 3 counting me.
That's 3 out of 10?
Mm-hmm. Something about like that.
That's not bad if you're playing baseball.
More people dream than want to do.
Yes. Hitting 300 is not bad.
I spent my first winter in the bush in 1970, I guess, and I loved it. I was in Denali Park right below the mountain. It was awesome. The fellow I had it all set up, his name was Bob, and he had it set up. He was a biologist out there, was studying the caribou because they're going to spin the herd, and I ended up going. I learned that I love the area, the isolation. There were 4 trappers who lived 5 miles away and 1 fella who lived 7 miles away. And what I realized that is that I could not do it there alone, or with one other person, and that I need a community. When I returned to Fairbanks and then got involved a little bit in the feminist movement, and the women's movement was kind of like the hippie movement right back there. There was a lot of back to the land. I went and visited in Oregon because there were several women's land being developed right then. And I didn't want to do what they were doing because they were talking more about doing it. I wanted to go back to the bush. And so a group of people joined me. I was going back anyway. And we landed in Fairbanks, and a woman said, there's this piece of land out there I staked out in 72 entry. If you can find it, it's yours. Keep it open to women, which I did. And like you, Alma, people would come through, they'd stay a week, mm-hmm. they'd stay a month, they'd go away, they were coming back. And just by my personality, I just was there on the ground building a cabin because I was very aware that winter was coming. So I don't know if I answered this question or not.
Yeah, I think you did, and I think you both have a profound sense of community that is largely lacking in this culture, and so part of that means playing psychotherapist on a daily basis, and you both do it in your very quiet way. You don't actively push or intrude yourselves into other people's lives. You just are open to having a conversation with them, and especially you living right there next to the community kitchen, you get people passing through all the time. So talk a little bit about that, the importance of community and your approach to facilitating community one person at a time without being pushy, but still managing to keep it going. I mean, it's easy to for me to imagine that relationships on a property could actually fall apart.
Yes, they can. My first group did.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, they can. So, I've learned a lot since then, though.
Right, and so how do you act? How do you act differently now than you did then on a daily basis with the people in your community?
I listen a lot more and I talk a lot less.
Uh-huh. And that makes you a shitty guest for a radio show, by the way.
I'm plumb sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. I was talking too much again.
And I try not to push my ideas, state them but not push them. I used to be pretty pushy the first time around. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Boo?
I think for me is that I was over here camping and I met most of the people that I'm involved in this community with out in the wilderness because I camped out there for many months. So for me, this community was actually a place to be where you could get supplies, maybe pound a few nails somewhere, get some money to buy more supplies and go back out to the wilderness. The group of people I'm living with now out of that was most of them were doing the same thing. We were together anyway. We'd learned how to camp together. We came back to this piece of land that was open to build community. And I feel like I just got stuck there, but I'm living with the same friends I was camping with. Throughout the years, we camp a lot together. So it was just like a lifestyle with built-in friends.
Mm-hmm.
And very valuable. I work very hard trying to figure out all the time and what I can do to enhance the quality that we already have.
So
what are, just you know, a lot of people come through to potluck that's every Sunday on at the land trust where all three of us live. And I was wondering if you could talk about when some of the experiences or an experience when people come through that, you know, are living traditional lives and maybe what is their reaction? Or do you just kind of observe people and watch how they react to the kitchen and to the beginning of potluck when we get up together and we all hold hands? I was wondering if you could talk about maybe some of the reactions or some of the things you've heard over the years from outsiders about coming into community, because most people, they don't know what community is.
I think people feel it when they come. I see this all the time. And we're not an open community. People who've, if they've made it as far as our kitchen, somebody's brought them. Somebody right. I know that we already know. So we don't have strangers wandering in off the street, which would be probably unacceptable for me. So they're kind of already on the right page as far as I'm concerned. They're already questing. They're already doing. Everybody's doing community somewhere. Believe me, there is nobody living isolated on this planet right now. They've got a church community. They've got a neighborhood community, a school community, a work. We're all doing community. So they're already there as far as I'm concerned. They're fascinated. They feel we have something very beautiful going on there that is probably not non-describable.
How about you, Anna? What are your thoughts about visitors that come in and their reaction?
They're surprised at us, and they are fascinated. And they're surprised that we managed to live together, and they're surprised that we managed to make it out here where nobody can, quote, make a living, unquote. Yeah. And they find us quite attractive. They like us.
Yeah. Do you try and pass on any sort of wisdom ever to people, like, you know, a little nugget for something then to take away, to think about, or, you know, because both of you are, I see we have conversations all the time with people that come and visit, and, you know, it's usually not lighthearted stuff. It's usually deep and on some philosophical level. Is there something you at least try to get through to people once in a while, or not?
Yeah. Actually, before I was in this community, I was living in a town north of here where there's a hot springs, and I used to sell my craft, which is sandals, at the hot springs on the weekend. And people would come down, and they would look at me, and they would say, oh, I wish I could live like you do. And I would tell them, well, you actually you can, but you have to get rid of three kinds of slavery. First, you have to get rid of consumer slavery, that need to buy all those things. Then you can get rid of debt slavery. And once you get rid of those two, you can get rid of wage slavery. And they all listened to me, and I don't think anyone ever did it. It's like there's a story in the Bible about the rich young ruler who came to Jesus because he was all in torment. And Jesus said, sell all your goods and give to the poor. And the rich young ruler went away sorrowful. Well, it was kind of like that.
You know, you talked about camping, and you both spend quite a bit of time in the nearby wilderness, days or even weeks at a time. Now, that alone is terrifying for most people in this culture.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I'm a lot more scared of their cities than I ever have been of a wilderness.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. So you both spent time in cities, obviously.
Well, yes. No more than I had to.
And Boo, you grew up in a big city.
Yeah, well, Tucson was not a big city back in 1958. And I was rural, so and I have since gone back to Tucson, and it's a doable, actually. Everything's alarming, no matter what. You know, if you're going into the city, if you're going into the country, I'm very comfortable just throwing my bed down on the ground, but I've survived doing that. Snakes have yet to eat me, bears have yet to eat me, nothing's yet to kill me out there. Same with the city. I have gone into cities. Nothing killed me there yet either.
Mm-hmm.
Fear not, I guess, probably is my main motto.
But obviously you're both very comfortable in the rural area where you mm-hmm. live, and more comfortable in the wilderness than in this urban wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how do you try to convince somebody who only knows sidewalks that it's actually not dangerous out here? Or do you even have that conversation? Is it too late for those people?
I don't know if it's too late. They probably don't need to be off their sidewalk. It's none of my business.
They generally don't show up out here.
Right. Well, occasionally I drag one out. Maybe that's just... Yeah, Karen raises her hand from the live studio audience. Mike is snickering there in the background.
Well, you can blame Guy for bringing me out. I think.
I think there's plenty of blame to go around here. All right. Well, thank you for the wonderful conversation, Amma and Boo. Thanks for joining us on Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nature Bats Last.
Guy, you got a climate update?
I do. I have a little bit of catching up to do. Last week's guest had plenty to say, so we ran a bit over time. I didn't include some of the following information in last week's updates, so that's why I'm providing it here. Microbes in soil, these are organisms that exert enormous influence over our planet's carbon cycle, may not be as adaptable to climate change as most scientists have presumed, according to a paper published March 2nd, 2016 in PLOS One. Quote, this study capitalized on a long-term reciprocal soil transplant experiment to examine the response of dry land soils to climate change. The two transplant sites were separated by 500 meters of elevation on the same mountain slope in eastern Washington State, USA, and had similar plant species and soil types. We resampled the original 1994 soil transplants and controls, measuring CO2 production, temperature response, enzyme activity, and bacterial community structure after 17 years, end quote. The bottom line, according to a write-up at phys.org, quote, the scientists found less adaptability than they expected, even after 17 years. While the microbial makeup of the samples did not change much at all, the microbes in both sets of transplanted soils retained many of the traits they had in their native climate, including to a large degree their original rate of respiration, end quote. In other words, even the smallest of organisms are not able to keep up with changes in climate. Rather, biological activity in soils is relatively constant in the face of large, rapid changes in climate. And I thought we were headed for a small world after all, but it turns out that even the small things are not able to keep up with ongoing changes in the global average temperature. The abstract of a paper published in the March 14th, 2016 online issue of Nature Geoscience includes these telling lines, quote, "Ice wedges are common features of the subsurface in permafrost regions. They develop by repeated frost cracking and ice vein growth over hundreds to thousands of years. We find that melting at the tops of ice wedges over recent decades and subsequent decimeter scale ground subsidence is a widespread Arctic phenomenon. Although permafrost temperatures have been increasing gradually, we find that ice wedge degradation is occurring on sub-decadal timescales. We predict that ice wedge degradation and the hydrological changes associated with the resulting differential ground subsidence will expand and amplify in rapidly warming permafrost regions." Vladimir Romanovsky, a University of Alaska Fairbanks geophysics professor who monitored ice wedge degradation for the study at a site in Canada, said the overall conclusions of the paper were striking. In an interview coincident with publication of the paper, he said, quote, "We were not expecting to see these dramatic changes. What is happening, it's something new for at least the last 60 years in the Arctic," end quote. Thus is born self-reinforcing feedback loop number 63. It's number 60 of the irreversible variety. Paper in the March 14, 2016 online issue of Nature Geoscience finds that Earth's climate sensitivity is slightly higher than was assumed by global climate models and much higher than reported in other observational studies. Specifically, atmospheric aerosol loading, quote, caused a cooling that masked approximately one-third of the continental warming due to increasing greenhouse gas concentrations over the past half century. Consistent with this result, another paper in the same issue of Nature Geoscience concludes that, quote, "air quality regulations in the Northern Hemisphere, the ocean and atmospheric circulation, and Arctic climate are inherently linked," end quote. Specifically, measures to enhance air quality by limiting pollution in Europe have served to warm the Arctic region. I hate to whine, but it seems like we can't get anything right. Okay, I like to whine. Pollution is bad, but removing pollution makes matters worse with respect to climate change. Seems civilization ain't all it's cracked up to be after all. The March 14th, 2016 issue of Nature Geoscience includes a paper about Antarctic ice shelves concluding that, quote, "loss of ice shelf mass is accelerating, especially in West Antarctica, where warm seawater is reaching ocean cavities beneath the ice shelves. We conclude that basal channels can form and grow quickly as a result of warm ocean water intrusion, and that they can structurally weaken ice shelves, potentially leading to rapid ice shelf loss in some areas." I've added this information to feedback number 7. This one is really important. It's from the March 21st, 2016 online issue of Nature Geoscience. That's just yesterday. The title of the paper is "Anthropogenic Carbon Release Rate Unprecedented During the Last 66 Million Years." That, by the way, precedes the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum, which occurred about 55 million years ago, during the PETM global average temperature spiked 5 degrees Celsius in only 13 years, according to a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and we're spewing carbon into the atmosphere faster than that, because as we all know, the mantra of civilization is must go faster. Several mainstream media outlets, including the New York Times and Washington Post, are headlining today's articles with something like this, and this one is actually from today's version of the New York Times. Quote, "Scientists warn of perilous climate change within decades, not centuries." These articles describe a paper co-authored by James Hansen and published this morning in the European Journal of Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. Hansen says it's the most important scientific work of his life. My favorite headline comes from Chris Mooney's article in the Washington Post. Quote, "We had all better hope these scientists are wrong about the planet's future." There's that four-letter word again, hope. Yep, that'll fix it. Finally, in the category of I can't believe I didn't think of this earlier, increased atmospheric carbon dioxide makes rainwater more acidic. The result is a relatively weak form of carbonic acid. The rainfall falls on limestone and related carbonate rocks, thus releasing carbon dioxide from the rocks into the atmosphere.
The stronger the carbonic acid, the more the limestone dissolves, hence releasing more carbon dioxide. It's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop, number 61 on the list of irreversible ones. Finally, you can catch my latest webinar on April 20th, 2016. It's sponsored by Audio Solutions, and it's described on the blog at the bottom of recent posts. Apparently, one of my biggest critics, so-called science educator Scott Johnson, welcomes any opportunity to criticize me. He's forking over the participation fee just to taunt me. And by taunt me, of course, I mean deny the evidence I present. So this ought to be fun. If you want to fork over the money just for the entertainment value, well, I couldn't exactly stop you, now could I?
How are we doing on time?
We're doing great. Why don't you walk us on home here?
All right. Well, folks, that wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Best Class, and Progressive Radio Network. And join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bad Class on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. Please share widely the link of information from this show. Continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, speaking tours, and webinars. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Dr. Helen Kelvicott because she lives in Australia, where the show broadcasts very early in the morning. Next week's show will be pre-recorded, so no calls. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archive at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our guests, Amma and Boo, as well as to our listeners for their music, and our Appazin for his music. And, of course, until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Come back.